Just a quick word from our sponsor before we jump into today's episode. Optimizing your internal processes can often be a huge unlock for streamlining revenue and getting you and your team, if you have one, out of a manual process. If you're looking to reduce costs and headaches in one fell swoop, consider graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere, and you cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Everything seems to be more expensive these days, so proven ways to cut costs and boost performance at the same time, like NetSuite, are kind of a no-brainer. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/SPI. netsuite.com/SPI. Once again, netsuite.com/SPI. And now a quick word from our sponsor before we start the show. Ready to earn sustainable income while creating the work you're passionate about? Get started with Memberful. Whether you teach online courses, host a podcast, run a blog, or write a newsletter, Memberful has all the tools you need to unlock revenue and deeply connect with your audience through subscription membership. Their platform allows you to easily gate content, communicate with your audience, and tier membership access directly on your own website. Plus, with Memberful, there's no need to change your workflow. They work seamlessly and integrate with the tools you already use, including MailChimp, Discord, Zapier, ConvertKit, Google Analytics, and more. Utilize their powerful built-in features and dashboards and watch your business grow. The best part? Memberful gives you full control and ownership of your audience, your brand, and your business. Get started for free at memberful.com/SPI. One more time, that's memberful.com/SPI.
You learn so much more and you grow so much more by being prolific and iterating on content. What I want to do is to increase the speed in which I have an idea and to make something so I can test constantly. And it's a difference between making small bets or one giant gamble. I'm a small bet kind of person. I'm going to keep making little bets.
Welcome to the Smart Passive Income Podcast, where it's all about working hard now so you can sit back and reap the benefits later.
And now your host, he loves to write emails because that's how he gets better at writing emails, Pat Flynn.
Our sponsor today is Uplift Desk, creators of office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. If you're like most entrepreneurs, you probably spend a lot of time sitting. Well, a standing desk can make a huge difference. It's actually a complete game changer. If you haven't tried one before, this offer from Uplift is for you. Plus, you can support the show at the same time. Visit UpliftDesk.com/SPI for 5% off your order. Over a million customers have chosen Uplift Desk. Innovative product designs, reasonable pricing, same-day shipping, free accessories with every desk. You can see why they're such a big hit. Standing while I work helps me get the creative juices flowing, helps me focus and stay productive, and I'm way more alert when I'm standing. And Uplift is a great deal. An industry-leading 15-year warranty, free shipping, free return shipping if you need to do that. And they provide a state-of-the-art experience. They're stable, made of very solid materials, and there are over 100 desktop choices and customizations available. Go to upliftdesk.com/SPI for 5% off your order. That's UPLIFT desk.com/SPI to get 5% off your entire order. So I recently had the pleasure of being a guest on Chris Doe's podcast, The Future. And Chris and his podcasts and his respective YouTube channel are massively huge. In fact, I've gone down many rabbit holes with Chris and his work. And I'm just so, so honored today to bring Chris on our show, on the Smart Passive Income podcast, to teach us how to position ourselves so that when we sell, we're not feeling gross. We're not feeling like we're selling out or doing something that doesn't make us comfortable. But at the same time, we sell our work, our creative, our art, our service, whatever it might be, and not get stomped on by other people and not get taken advantage of. And all this stuff is really, really important. And Chris has really amazing ways to share with us exactly how to sort of nuance this and position ourselves in a way of power. And I think it's really important. We also talk a lot about value and where it comes from and how to show that value that you have to offer to others, how to get paid on time, how to also understand how to use content to support what it is that you are selling. So all that and more today in this episode with Chris Doe. This is session 553 of the Smart Passive Income podcast. I hope you enjoy it. Chris, welcome to the Smart Passive Income podcast. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Pat. I'm super excited.
So you're on this mission to help 1 billion creatives do the work that they love without selling their soul. And absolutely love that. Where did this inspiration come from to do such a huge, big, audacious thing?
There's two parts to this story. The first part is I've been teaching at Art Center for 15 years at this point. And Art Center prides itself on a low teacher to student ratio. So my classes at most would be like 12 students. And I love that. I love the intimate nature. I love being able to critique someone's work for 20, 25 minutes and not feel rushed for time. And I think that's a wonderful experience. And it is at that point in time in which I started to think about, can I make a bigger impact on more people? And I also realized that Art Center is a wonderful private art school. Currently, I think the tuition is $22,000 a semester. So it means that very few people have access to this kind of education. And my wife prompted me like, you know, think about doing something bigger than this. And then eventually I get to start to teach and teach online. It starts to make a difference. And I'm feeling like, wow, this is a dynamic new medium to teach through YouTube. And I have the equipment and the crew and the know-how to make these videos. And we're sitting in a conference room with my management team. And they're like, we're really confused, man. Do you want to sell products? Do you want to grow your YouTube channel? What are you trying to do here? And they kind of pushed me into a corner to give clarity in the direction of what it is that we're doing. And that's when I told them, you know what? Okay, fair question. What we're trying to do here is to make sure that Ben's little girl, when she's 18 and she wants to think about going to design school, that the future exists and that she could sit there and say, I could go to A or B and there's no difference in terms of quality of education. We have a lot of work to do, but this is for her and we're gonna try and change it. So that night I went to sleep. Next day I woke up. I'm like, that's a really freaking long story. I need to just condense this thing down. So I messaged my chief operating officer. His name is Ben. I said, Ben, our mission is to teach a billion people how to make a living doing what they love without feeling gross. He goes, I love it. So that was my team forcing me to crystallize what it is that we're trying to do.
I mean, the power of conversation to get these things out of you, right? For sure. To have people push you. Now, how do you balance the idea of at art school teaching a person one-to-one essentially and offering 22, 25 minutes of individual help for that person? And then using the internet, which is so disconnected from people and not one-to-one, but 1 to, you know, a billion potentially.
Yeah.
How can you still provide value in this medium versus like you might do in person?
Yeah, they're very different experiences for sure. And I'm not trying to tell anyone who's used to teaching a small group classroom discussion, lecture, or critique that it can be the same. It's not meant to be the same. I remember one of my classes at Art Center, it was called Critiquing Current Films. Mm. What a great class. I get to watch movies and get a grade and take care of an academic unit. But one of the things that the professor said, his name is Jay Chapman, he said, you know what? Let's just get rid of this thing that you're all going to say. I read the book. I like the book better. He's like, a film is an entirely different experience with the whole different things, art direction, design, music, score, editing. And a book is wonderful because it's a film that plays in your mind. But this is a whole different thing. So we're not going to compare the two. And that really stuck with me. So I don't think me teaching on a YouTube video can be the same, but it doesn't need to be. It can be very different and can be a wholly satisfying and rewarding experience on its own. You have to learn how to teach in a way that's much more rhetorical, in that you give people prompts and things to do, but then it's entirely up to them to do it. And of course, they don't get the feedback. But if you wanted all that feedback, you would have gone to university and you would have done it that way. So it's an alternative to and not a replacement for.
Was it challenging for you to get on the internet and start teaching? And what were the big challenges that you personally had while doing so?
Yeah, the biggest challenge, Pat, is that I don't like the way I look. I don't like the way I sound. And I definitely don't want to be on camera. And it was a big hurdle to get over. And you know, the funny thing is I would tell my students, like, I'm an introvert. I'm horribly shy and awkward in real life in most ways. If you ever saw me at a party and if I didn't know enough people there, I'd be the guy who's standing by the corner with a drink in his hand, like not knowing what to do. That is literally me. And they're like, we can't see this about you, you know, instructor, we can't. And I'm like, well, you just have to take my word for it. And so the idea of taking this super awkward person that I am, recording it for everyone to see forever, that's this very scary thing. So to me, that was just the biggest challenge. Just off the top, like, I don't want to do this. And I resisted. If it wasn't for my friend and former college alumni, he very graciously said to me, I know you don't want to do this. We need to do this. I need you. And you just sit there and don't say anything. When you're ready to speak, go ahead. And I knew that this offer was genuine because his name is Jose Caballero. So he could talk forever for like hours on end without even taking a breath. You know, he's a super intelligent guy. He has some ADHD thing. So he could just talk forever. He's like a Gary Vaynerchuk type. So that was enough for me to say, all right, I'll try. And so that was kind of like my training wheels into recording content for others to consume.
And now you have this YouTube channel with 1.8 million viewers or subscribers on the future. And has YouTube become the sort of center of your content hub and platform, or are there other things outside of that?
It is, I would say that it is part of my content platform, one of the few that I'm active on. But for me, it'll always be home. I feel like I grew up on YouTube. I mean, I'm not a young man, but that was my foray into social media and content creation. So there's a special place in my heart for it. You know, you can't ever forget your first love. So YouTube definitely is it. I do have a podcast. I do post things on Instagram and on LinkedIn and Twitter, but YouTube is still like where I spend most of my brain thinking about like, how can we do better?
Now you have a video. It's your most popular video. It's just a short, it's 59 seconds, but it has 42 million views. And in this video, you are conversing with somebody at an event. And I know you run events quite often and speak at events, but you're having this very genuine conversation about being charged an hourly wage and why that's bad.
Yeah.
Let's start there in terms of if you are creative, and we're going to talk all about if you're creative, how you, you know, get paid for what you do. One of those things is, well, you have to ask people to pay you, but hourly is what we're used to. Why is hourly bad when it comes to servicing our art and our creative?
Ooh, you're opening up a can of worms. This might be the part of the podcast that goes crazy for people. All right, here we go. Everybody buckle in because we're going to get into it. So I've done some research on this. A lot of what I do is through intuition or through some mentorship that I've had in my life. And then now I'm going back and just reading about the theory behind it. So there's something called the labor theory of value, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're supposed to charge a fair amount based on the necessary labor to make something. So if somebody bakes a loaf of bread, there's labor involved in it, time and materials, essentially. And we feel like that's a fair thing. So capitalism doesn't accept this as an idea, as a concept. And the labor theory of value is heavily tied to Marx, Karl Marx, and socialism, whatever. So there's a whole thing there. But it has been, for the longest time, how we measure value. Something is worth more because it took a longer time to make it. That's what we tell ourselves, right? So if I were to say to you, look, you want to buy a car. Let's say you're into like a BMW. And you're like, well, there's a lot of materials. There's a lot of know-how. It's like hundreds of man hours to produce this thing. So it's worth $50,000. But then you get into this thing where somebody sketches a logo for you or builds you a sales funnel or helps to coach you to do like an amazing podcast. You and I are sitting here struggling with, well, that didn't take you a long time to do. But that doesn't mean it's any less valuable. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about time and effort. Okay. So a lot of people equate time and effort into value. Let's look at that. So from the craftsperson, the creative human being who's going to make something, yes, more time, more effort is more valuable because I can't replace the time I gave you. So if I work on something for 600, 700, 800 hours, I have to charge you an appropriate sum for that. Makes total sense, right? On the surface. Right. But what happens is on the other side, the buyer of the creative services is not looking at it the same way you as the maker of those things are. For example, if I want you to build me a website and you say it's going to take 4 months, is it more or less valuable than another person who's like, I can build you that same website in 1 month? And in this case, the buyer would pay more to get it done in less time. So the expression time is money, depending on how you look at it, is true in both cases. So for the person who's laboring on this, time is money. More time equals more money. From the buyer's perspective, less time is actually more money. It's why we pay rush fees for shipping for Amazon or for UPS. Right. Anything that you want done faster from the buyer's point of view actually will cost you more time. I mean, more money. Mm-hmm. So then now we have to start to decouple this idea that more labor and time is equal to greater value, because in this case, the buyer is the person who gets to determine how much value it is to them. So we have this unhealthy mindset that we're like, it takes me this long to make it, therefore I should be able to charge you more for it, right? But if it has right. no intrinsic value to the person buying it, I don't care how long you work on it. And the last thing I'll say on this is usually there's two things that determine value. There's utility value, and then there's replacement value. So water has high utility value because without it, you would die. You can't grow a crop without water. So it's actually absolutely essential. But its replacement value is very low. There's not that many things you can exchange for water, right? Now, on the other hand, take, for example, a diamond. A diamond has actually fairly low utility value, but high replacement value. Because theoretically, they're precious, they're rare, supposedly. Then you could exchange that diamond for a car. And so we have to kind of understand this and hopefully start to take a more business and pragmatic look at value.
So when it comes to the services that we offer, knowing that, well, the time that we could save somebody by hiring us is of value is really, really important. How do we decouple, especially for the artist, the artiste, the creative who has essentially a mindset of, well, I'm putting my own time and my own care into this. Therefore, you know, the more hours I put in, the more valuable it is on our side, like a bonsai tree, right? A bonsai tree might take, you know, 30 years. Does it mean it's more valuable if it only took 1 year to make it look like that? I think inherently a bonsai tree being art and being something like that, you know, it inherently has more value because it took more time to get it to that point. Almost like a fine, you know, wine, if you will, or aged cheese or whatever it might be.
Yeah. Wine is a great case, by the way.
Yeah. Talk more about that.
Yeah. Okay. So we say that some wines or some very rare whiskey or scotch, I don't drink at all, so I don't know, but I know that they're like aged for 15 years and then this and that. There's a whole process to it. So they can't just make them as fast as you want them. And so there's a process and they have to care for that thing for a really long time. But ultimately, the buyer don't care. So let me try and explain this. So if the whiskey takes 100 years to age and to mature and you taste it and it tastes terrible, unless you told yourself it's going to taste great no matter what, then it doesn't matter to you. But if we as a society get together and say, you know what, certain vintages age really well and there's a richness and boldness and thing to the flavor, and we're willing to pay for it. But you know what we're really paying for these $100, $200, $5,000 bottles is the idea that we can afford such things.
Right.
You're exactly right. And that's really what we're paying for. So like, this has happened to me. I've gone to like wine warehouses. I don't drink at all, but they're like easy gifts to give to people. And I say, okay, I need to buy my clients who I really appreciate. I need to buy some for my relatives who I appreciate sort of, but not totally. And then there's some that I just need to give away, right? And so then I go to it and I go and shop in sections where the bottles are of a certain price point, because the last thing I want my client or my relatives to think is I'm some cheap person and I'm giving you a $7 bottle of wine, even though technically it might taste better than a $100 bottle of wine. I buy that just to say, like, look, this is a gift. This is a token of my appreciation to you. So you're really getting into the real understanding of value at this point. And it has not as much to do with what you think in terms of the glass, the actual flavor, all those kinds of things. They do matter, but not as much as you would think.
Now on that video, the 42 million video, some of the top comments are actually very similar. There are people saying things like, you know, you might be buying this thing that takes me an hour, but you're also buying the 10 years of expertise and time and education that I put into learning how to do this in just an hour. So you can figure it out on your own and, you know, save some money, if you will, or you can invest in me to help you do it quicker and not have to go through all that education. And I love that. How does a person who is providing a service or creating for somebody, a person designing a website or a person creating a logo, for example, or ghostwriting for somebody or something like that, how does one best portray the fact that there is that much time that I've put into learning how to do this thing quickly for you?
Yeah.
What's the best way to do that?
Good. Great question. I think the best way is not to do it, to be honest. And so the minute that you have to start to justify to your prospective client how long it takes you, what kind of education, the pedigree, the awards you've won, you've already lost, because at this point you're justifying. And justification is you ceding the higher ground. You're coming at it and lowering yourself to say, I must prove myself to you. The best way to talk about value is to ask the client, let's just say it's a website. And so instead of talking about my pedigree, what I've done in the past, I'm going to just put all that stuff aside and I'm going to say to them, and I like to start from a negative position because it puts me in a position of power to say, like, I understand you want to do a website, but is it necessary? Will this impact your business at all? And then I get them to tell me why they want to do something versus me trying to prove to them that it's valuable. And so now it puts them into this position where if they say it's valuable, they're going to pay more. If they say it's not valuable, then I'm going to say, let's not do this at all, which is not the case, right? Because most people who are coming to you that want a website or a video or to be coached to do something, they have already recognized I have a problem, and only by spending money and hiring people or buying services or products can I make my problem go away. And so if you ask them this question to say, like, why even do this? Will this even do anything for your business? And then I find that most of the times the client or the prospect is going to say, well, here's what it's going to do. First, I'm tired of Johnny down the street having a better website than us. It's embarrassing for me and my team. They just started, and we've been a family business for 80 years. I think it can help us to sell more product. They're going to go through and list one thing after the other as to what they hope the website's going to do for their business. And this is true of everything. Like, whenever you hire somebody, you're thinking to yourself, what am I getting out of this? So if we, the service provider, focus on what they're getting versus like everything it took us to make it, because they don't really care at the end of the day, then we can start to focus truly on the value to the buyer.
How are you bringing people in top of funnel for a conversation like that? I mean, I imagine you might want to get on a call, for example, for a 15-minute sort of just discovery call, for example, or it might be a person coming onto a webinar, or there could be a number of different ways that you could bring people in from the top to get them interested. Let's just keep on this example of a website. You know, we've done what we could to perhaps convince them that, you know, a website's right for them and that we might have something they might need. Are you saying that if they come on the call, just go, okay, well, like, what do you even think this website's going to do for you? Like, legit asking that question, would that not come across as, well, shouldn't you know what it's going to do for me, and this is the whole reason you exist? Like, I'm just trying to nuance that conversation a bit, just so I can understand more about, well, why do we need to approach it that way, or why that might be a good approach?
Right. Okay. So your question threw me for a curveball, because I thought you were asking me a different question at the top.
And okay. Then it was like, well, I'm going to ask you what you thought I was going to ask after this.
Okay. So let me answer that first, and then we'll go back to like the challenge and the pushback, because I love just, you know, having a deeper dive into this.
No,
so what are we doing for top of the funnel awareness so that we're even getting into this conversation in the first place, right?
Okay.
So you, right? So I read this just the other day on Twitter. Somebody wrote, writing is networking for introverts. And I love that because I'm an introvert. And I'm like, okay. So I'm just going to change it. I'm like, well, content creation is networking for introverts. Or if you suck at sales and if you don't like networking, make your content really good. So that then it starts to rank higher on search, and also it gets shared on LinkedIn and other platforms where people who are looking for you right now, someone who has a problem, you just make it easier to find you. So for me, marketing is very simple. It could be boiled down to this: make it easier to find you than your competitors. That's it. So if your content game is really strong, the client's going to look at your work, or they're going to read things about you. They're like, why am I keep seeing this person in my feed on YouTube, on Instagram, wherever? And so at a certain point, they're going to feel like I need to reach out. So the client's already made up a couple of decisions in their mind already. One is, I have a problem. They already know they have a problem, because otherwise they're not calling you. Two, you potentially can solve that problem. Otherwise, again, I'm not calling you. And as it turns out, there are studies that have been done that there's at least 50% of the clients who call you, they have already made up their mind if they want to work with you or not. So at this point, the only thing you could do is totally screw it up, right? It used to be that you'd have to pitch and sell them. But at this point, because there's so much data and information available, clients are very smart. They're shopping before they talk to you. So now they get on the phone with you. Now we're going to get to the second part, which is, so Pat, I heard you make videos or websites, and what is the value of this thing? And then you asked me that same question, which I said, which was, I don't know. But before we dive into this, before we assume that you need a website, tell me what you think a website's going to do for you. If they push back, and now this is where we're at, if they're like, well, isn't this your job? right? And here's how I would respond to this. It is my job to connect your users, your customers to your company and give them a delightful user experience that is reflective of your brand and your brand values. But I have no idea what this is going to do for your business. And then this is usually where I'll say something like, some clients come to me and say, we absolutely need a website. Then they overbuild a website only to find out later it's misaligned with their business goal, that their customers actually don't spend a lot of time on the web, that a strategic video kind of delivered to targeted email lists will be much more effective than having a website that no one will go to. So I would be happy to take your money to build you a site. But from a business point of view, it's unethical for me to do this unless I understand what it might actually do for your business.
What a valuable response, actually, that is, right? You're almost, in a way, coaching a person and helping them figure it out either way. And if they're not ready for it, you don't really want them to be the client, I would say.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I do say this, like, I'm happy to take your money. And some people do insist. They're like, I don't care. Just charge me whatever. I'm like, okay, but I've done my part. But you know what you've done there is that you're rising in esteem in your client's eyes because you're really straightforward. You're looking out after my best interests and not your own. Hmm. And I find that if you can just approach these calls with this kind of mindset, you're going to be much better off. You're going to close at a higher rate and it's going to be a lot less friction for you throughout the entire sales cycle.
One struggle I know a lot of entrepreneurs have, especially who, you know, unlike myself who creates online courses and has students, a person who might get clients and has a lot of, you know, hours to put in to service that client in some way, shape or form. You know, there's a couple of things that go along with that. Undercharging is a very common thing.
Right.
I'd love to dive into why do you think we undercharge and how to combat that. Oftentimes, the answer is literally double what you think, and we end up closer at least to where we should be. But do you have any formulas or any strategies in terms of how to properly price ourselves into the work that we do for our client, especially if it's not obviously a per hour, it took me this many hours, therefore this is how much it costs?
Yeah, I have a couple different things and very high level. I'll tell you all the different models and then we can dive or go wherever you want to go with this, okay?
Sure, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, there's a couple ways to price any project. One is time and materials. This is the easiest thing. This is what most freelancers do. This is how much time it takes me. These are the materials I have to use. So based on that, this is the estimate. And the one thing that we need to remember is an estimate, it's not a bid. It's not a fixed price because if it takes more time, I will charge you more. If it takes less time, I'll charge you less. Some mistakes that rookies make is they say, oh, it's going to take 40 hours to do this. And then it winds up taking them 60, but they committed to the 40 hours and they screwed themselves over. What are the pros and cons of doing this? One, it doesn't take a lot of effort and energy. There's very low risk to you, the seller of creative services. There is some risk to the buyer because they don't know, A, I'm going to get a result that I want, or B, how long and how much money it's going to take. If you want to see someone who's really uneasy, just have a running bill that you have no control, no transparency over. So that's one of the problems. So eventually, as you're working with your clients, they're going to say something like, Pat, I love working with you. I need to have like a fixed fee. I don't care what it takes you to do. I just need you to charge me a fixed fee because I'm going to get that approved. Once I get it approved, I don't want to hear from you again because unless I change my mind on something, that's what it's going to cost. And you say, okay, this is great. So now you're now taking the risk on because if you underprice this thing, you're going to be hating yourself for this. So what you do is you build in some kind of pad, more hours than you think you need, and you're going to build in some kind of profit margin so that if you underestimate, you'll still be okay. And the client already knows this and they accept that you have to account for unforeseeable circumstances. So you give them a fixed fee. So now we've graduated from the hourly base estimate and now we're moving into a fixed fee bid. Here, you really need to know what it's going to take because you can totally screw yourself over. My advice to you is charge enough so that if you mess up here or there, or if you underestimate, it's still not going to be a problem and you can still deliver excellent customer service. Okay. The third part of this is to price based on results or outcomes. So you know what? It's got nothing to do with how hard I work on this. I'm here to get you an outcome that you want. So if you want to improve conversions on your site by 1%, if you want to double your downloads for your podcast, I'm going to help you do that. And now I need to understand, you have to have the value-based conversation now. What is that worth to you? Well, say Pat, for you, for example, let's say you get 10,000 downloads per episode, right? And you're like, well, my advertisers pay me X on this. And if I could double the downloads, that's at least worth double my revenue just from an ad point of view. And if we can apply this over the course of a year, it's going to be worth, let's say, $100,000. Okay, so now we understand how valuable it is to you. And then I would just then ask you, Pat, how much do you want to spend to make this happen? Well, in your mind, as little as possible, and in my mind, as fairly as possible. And so that's just the discussion that we're going to have. So usually people start off with around 20%. I'll just throw that out there. It's like usually people spend about 20%. Are you willing to spend 20K to do this? And you've done a lot of wonderful things if you've had the conversation just like this. Because the first thing I did was I focused on what's valuable to you. I focused on the results that matter to you. And you got to tell me the number, which is $100,000. And so that is a price anchor now at this point. So 20K relative to 100K is not that much money. You still can clear 80K, which if you could do that deal every day of the week, you would.
1,000%.
Right? Yeah.
Numbers don't lie.
Yeah, they don't lie. And one of the things my business coach told me is nothing is expensive or cheap absent context. You have to understand relative to what. So if I didn't have the value conversation with you and I said something like, well, I'm probably gonna have to work on this for 200 hours, blah, 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 four team members, we're gonna do X, Y, and Z. Your eyes are rolling. You don't care. Like, why are you telling me all this stuff? And then I say, it's gonna cost you 20K to do this. You're gonna be, get out of town, man, 20K. You know what I can buy for 20K? You're thinking about the replacement costs.
Right?
Like I could buy something else for this. I could buy a new microphone. I could buy a new camera. I could hire three people to work for me for a period of time. Why would I pay you that? Because I haven't done enough in establishing the value in your mind from your point of view.
I mean, it goes back to that original question of, well, what would doing this do for your business, right?
That's right.
Goes right back to it.
Yeah, I want the client to tell me what it's going to do. And if they can't tell me a good reason, let's look for a problem worth solving then.
How do you ensure a client doesn't walk all over you and continue to ask you for more and more?
Okay, there's two ways. You can charge them so much money that they can ask you for more and more and you don't care. I would prefer that way because then you can provide the best customer service in the world. Some of the most notable hotels and restaurants do this. It's so expensive to stay at the Ritz-Carlton that they anticipate their clients are going to ask them for sometimes unreasonable things and they're happy to do it. And you know what happens? The customer is happy to pay it and then they tell more people. But that's a very privileged place to be able to say, I charge so much money. I don't care if you call me on a Friday at 5 p.m. I'm just happy to hear from you because you paid for the kids' tuition. You put the pool in my backyard, all those kinds of things. Okay, so we can't do that. The other way that we can do is we can have very clear scope and terms. And so we say, okay, after we do some scoping, we figure out you're going to need X, Y, and Z. It's going to take this long. And these are the parameters in which we put around it so that if you go outside of that, I'm happy to do it, but I just have to charge you more. And this is where a lot of creators make a mistake. They don't have clear a scope of work agreements. And so the clients can say, I want this. And there's nothing for you to point to say, well, that's out of scope because you didn't do a good job defining scope.
This is great, Chris. Thank you. Sorry, I'm just exploring the next question.
Take your time, man. Take your time.
Yeah. No, I'm thinking of all the potential downfalls that freelancers especially might go through, especially with a lack of experience. Another issue that I know a lot of freelancers and entrepreneurs have, especially when it comes to client work, is just the payment terms. You know, you don't get paid up front all of it necessarily all the time. Right. And I think that's less common. There might be a 50% up front, 50% upon completion type of thing. And there's all different kinds of things in between. But I also have heard the horror stories of, and this is why I'm grateful that, you know, I don't do a lot of client work, is because sometimes the clients don't necessarily pay on time. It could be a chore to, you know, get that payment. How do you recommend you protect yourself from A, putting yourself in that position, or being in that position, excuse me. And then B, if you are in that position, how could you get paid?
Yeah. In my life, in running a creative service agency for 25 years, I've only been screwed over by small operators. I've never been screwed over by a big corporation. They have too much going on to like deal with like not paying you on something, right? So all the ad agencies, any of these $100 million companies and up, they have no problems paying you. They might hem and haul here and there, but they're going to pay you. I've never been stiffed. It's always been the mom and pops, the under 5-person agency or studio that hires us that then says, I don't feel like paying you anymore. And I don't care because I don't have a professional reputation to protect. So I'd be very wary of that first, to understand who your clients are and the level of risk you're assuming. So if you've determined that there's high risk, you need to get more of it up front and you need to get paid on delivery, because otherwise you have no leverage and they don't care. Their time is less valuable than yours. So you going after them in small claims court or filing a complaint against in a Better Business Bureau, it's not going to matter to them. You're going to lose more money doing that. So what I recommend is following a simple rule, 50-25-25, 50% upfront. When I receive the deposit, the transfer of money into my account, I will begin the project, not a moment before. So if you say you have 3 weeks to do this, you better send the money tomorrow. And I want it to be a wire transfer. I don't want to receive credit card payment, because credit card payments can be challenged, and they often are. And if you've ever had to deal with this, Pat, I'm sure you have, is that the credit card company always sides with their customer. Always.
Yeah.
And you're screwed. And there's not a lot you can do about that. So this is why I want a wire transfer. The bank confirms that the money is there. I'm good to go. Next best is the check. And so once the check clears, then I'm good to go. Either one's okay. The 25 comes in when you've crossed over a major milestone, you send them another bill for 25%. And this will give you a good indicator as to how quickly they pay. They had to pay you 50% upfront because you wouldn't start. But if it takes them 2 or 3 weeks, you can, all right. So the final payment might even take longer, right? So that's your first warning sign. If they don't pay this, you have to stop working, right? And then you're going to get to this final part, which is the last 25%. And if you bid your project well, you at least have paid for everybody and have made a little bit of money. But this last 25% is probably going to come out of your profit margin if they stiff you. So we can still survive. It's not great, but we can survive. The last 25% is you let them know ahead of time that the project is going to deliver on a Tuesday and you need the final payment before you release the files or turn over X, Y, and Z. And they're like, okay, we're going to work with the accountant. We're going to make sure you get this check and you're going to be paid. And depending on your level of trust and how it's been going so far, you can give them some leeway, or you can say, look, it's due in 20 days, due in 14 days, et cetera. And the last thing I would do is I would include a late payment penalty in your terms and conditions to say, like, for every day after this, you're going to be charged some kind of interest rate that's compounded monthly.
I have a student of mine who has gone through something with a smaller client of theirs who wasn't paying on time, and they were friends. And when you bring friendship into this as well, it starts to add a little bit of, you know, weirdness, sometimes stickiness. You don't want to hurt feelings, but you also have business to do. How does one navigate the relationships that they have with their client and the friendships that might be formed with, you know, business at hand and deliverables and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah. I'm going to separate this into two parts. There are business acquaintances that you're friendly with, and then your friends that you grew up in high school with. And so let's talk about the latter of the two.
Okay.
If you have a deep relationship with them and that you want to preserve and protect, the best thing that I can tell you to do is A, don't work with them. It's just not worth it. Either you don't poo where you sleep or eat. Generally speaking, I just don't like it. It's generally not worth it. And I'll tell you why. You expect them to be super cool. They expect you to be super easy. And there's a lot of things that are taken for granted that can poison a relationship. And unless it's some once in a lifetime opportunity, I wouldn't do it. There are stories within our industry where two brothers no longer speak to each other because they were business partners. And now they can no longer go to family gatherings because if he shows up, I'm not showing up. And we're talking about even twins sometimes. So this can be a dividing thing. Like, business acquaintances, if you never talk to them again, your life will be okay. When it comes to family and friends, I'm just going to be very careful. But let's just say you're like, I got to do this. It's good for them. It's good for me. What I would do is say to them, I want to treat you like you're a real client. I'm going to run this as professionally as I can. I think it's good for you. It's good for me. We're going to protect each other. So there's going to be a contract. There's going to be payment terms. I'm not going to treat you any different. You're going to get the best service, and I'm not going to take you for granted. And if you're already getting weird feelings about it, I would just stop and say, you know what? I'm not going to do it. This is the reason why, because I have a lot of cousins. No cousins work for me. No friends of cousins work for me, because I still want to see you at the Thanksgiving dinner.
That's great advice. It can be hard though, because especially when you get a good idea and you're both jamming on it, you both went to high school, you have this relationship, you could talk very openly about how excited you are about something, but definitely something to pay attention to. And I think the contract is probably the smartest thing in the world if you choose to work with somebody in that way, whether it's a client or a business partner. I think it's important to think about that. Now, as we finish up here, Chris, this has been amazing. I'd love to go back to top of funnel and specifically content creation. What is your strategy for content creation? Obviously, with so many views on YouTube as well as a podcast and a blog as well, how do you approach organic in such a way that will then bring potential clients in?
Yes, I've tried both organic and paid content. Organic works way better. I guess the term that people in the advertising space are using is paid versus earned media. Paid, you have to pay people to get placement. Earned media is because if it's good enough, people will just check it out and they'll share it in an organic way. So they have some kind of intrinsic motivation to share your content because it gives them also status and clout. Like, I just discovered something. Jimmy, I think this will be helpful for your business. Or Mary, there's something here you need to see. And this is the best kind of sharing that you're going to be able to get. So put more of your energy in towards creating content that people are going to care about and to share. My particular strategy is very straightforward. There are two approaches. One is sit down and really plan and build something just ginormous. Case in point is Mr. Beast. He did a video that is the real life version of the Squid Games. It has 170 million views. I can't believe it. That's nuts. Months of planning, preparation, almost $500,000 worth of giveaway. So he's that kind of person who's going to sit around and say, we're going to plan, and we're going to build this thing. And it's a giant gamble. If it doesn't work, he's out probably $750,000, maybe to $1 million. He's out of that money, can never get it back. Not much of a gamble for Mr. Beast because he's figured out his formula. But assuming that you're not Mr. Beast, I would just caution you towards this approach. People can sit there and plan content for months and then they'll release something and then no one cares. And it could be very debilitating. It could lead to depression and anxiety and all kinds of things. I'm of the other mindset, which is you learn so much more and you grow so much more by being prolific and iterating on content. So that's the approach that I take. What I want to do is to increase the speed in which I have an idea and to make something so I can test constantly. And it's a difference between making small bets or one giant gamble. I'm a small bet kind of person. I'm going to keep making little bets. So the way I do that is I will jump on Twitter. I will put out some ideas and I'll see like what people are responding to, what touches a nerve. It's not always what I think it is. Counterintuitively, the ones that I tend to spend the most time thinking about get the worst performance. And the ones where I'm like, oh, I'm just feeling something, and I just write it in 5 seconds. And then that's the one that takes off. So that gives me a clue as to what's working, what people care about. And then I'll take that tweet and I'll turn it into an Instagram carousel. And generally speaking now, because I know it worked on Twitter, if I had some design and a refined thinking, it'll probably work on Instagram. And if that works, then I'll take that and I'll transform that into like a whiteboard session and make a YouTube video out of it. Each time my confidence is growing, I'm becoming a little bit smarter, and I'm also having, in a strange way, a bi-directional conversation with the audience so that they inform me as to what's valuable and what's not. And if I keep doing it that way, it works out really well.
So it starts on Twitter in most cases for you?
For me, it does, yeah.
How do you determine whether something's hitting or not? What are the metrics you use for that?
If I just look at it relative to my account size and how much interaction I get. So if something gets over 1,000 likes and over a number, whatever number of reshares, I know that's a solid piece of content, but that bar can go up or down. I just want to have some sense that this is what people care about before I go and invest more time. And so here's the cool thing about Twitter. No one takes it that seriously. If there's a typo, if your grammar isn't perfect, they understand it's Twitter. As long as you don't say something evil and horribly racist or misogynistic, the little grammar errors that people will generally forgive you for. But the other way I use Twitter is that when people, and because there are a lot of really smart people out there, they comment back and they share other resources. They're like, here's another quote, here's another idea. Or the original person who said what you're saying is this person. And I follow up on all those loose threads. And then now it's informing me on what I can do in the next phase. So I look at Twitter as what it is. It's very ephemeral. It lives a very short period of time, just maybe a few hours. And before I move it on to like Instagram, Instagram's going to live a little bit longer, not much longer, maybe 2 days. And then I think YouTube, well, the reason why I love YouTube is it kind of lives forever.
YouTube is, I'm having a lot of fun with YouTube, to be honest. Yeah. And in fact, you might not know this, but the SPA podcast currently is now living on YouTube here in 2022. And we're experimenting with little clips and a different channel to put the full episodes to see what happens there. I think there's going to be a lot of podcast / video things happening in the future. So I'm excited for that. But I'd love to ask you, what is an example of something you might post on Twitter? Like maybe something on your mind now or something that you posted recently that has gotten some engagement, and I'd love to like hear how you went from Twitter to Instagram to YouTube, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. So here's the funny thing. And this is, you're like, wait, you didn't follow your own formula. I know. Formula has rules. You break your own formulas, people. That's what happens, right?
Okay.
So I'm having a live stream with some of my friends from my community, and we're just talking about something. And I said something, and I said, you know, sometimes you got to just fake it till you make it. And they're like, giving me that sour look, like fake, because the word fake is in there, right? And nobody wants to be fake. And it's like, okay. So I sat there. I'm like, all right, I know you don't like that term. I'll say it a different way so you can accept it. I said, sometimes you have to believe it to achieve it. Same idea, quite literally the same idea, but now the word fake isn't there. And so now it's about belief. Mm-hmm. And like, I like that, Chris. And then people on the live stream are like, oh, we like that. So I took that exact same expression, you know, you got to believe it to achieve it. I put it on Twitter and then it starts to light up. And I literally like say, I said, some people don't like this term, fake it till you make it. So then you could use this other one called believe it till you achieve it. And then people are sharing other kinds of comments, one of which is a guy named Blair Enns, who's the writer who I look up to. And he said, you know, I'm reminded of the four C's from, I'm forgetting his name now, Dan Sullivan. You know, have the courage to commit to something to build the competency and leads to confidence. I'm like, that's even better. And so I take all those ideas and I go onto Instagram and I create a 10 slide carousel. And, you know, fake it till you make it or believe it till you achieve it is two slides. What am I going to do with 8 more slides here? Mm-hmm. So I incorporate some of the feedback and some of the ideas and suggestions, and I create a 10 slide carousel out of that that then performs really well. So each one of these things, I'm trying to build up on that.
Yeah.
And then I don't have a whole talk on this, but I could have just taken that one carousel. And now I'm like, okay, now I'm going to do a deep dive. I'm going to do some research. I'm going to have people help me sit down and write concepts and ideas, because this is actually touching people. And that would have been a good piece of content.
And then if you create a YouTube, your YouTube video would be like a presentation or kind of like a talk type thing.
Yes.
About that. You also post a lot of clips from workshops and things that you do that work mm-hmm. out really well on YouTube as well. I think the realness of that and the actual conversations that are happening, is that something you suggest we do more of, is just turn the camera on for those moments wherever we are, essentially, to capture and post on there?
As far as I can tell, Pat, people are emotionally charged. They're on camp A or camp B. And if you say something that is going against their core beliefs, they will respond. I don't engineer our videos to do that, but in the course of talking for an hour and a half to 2 hours, someone's going to say something, and then I'm going to say back to them in very emphatic ways that are going to just charge people up. I don't mean to do this. I'm not the Paul Crowder, Louder with Crowder guy, who's like, male whiteness is not a thing, prove me wrong or whatever. He's mm-hmm. deliberately provoking people to get into a fight, but his content works because you're either on camp A or camp B. And so one of the secrets to having videos and content that performs well is you have to be willing to be polarizing. I don't mean that to be your intention, but you have to have a point of view and you have to take a stand. And once you do, something wonderful happens. So almost all the shorts that have performed well for us is me engaging with someone, speaking like in a very real way. I think you're wrong. Here's why. Hear me out. And hopefully I'll change your mind. And it's something like that. It's not always said in that nice way, but that's how I see it in my head. And so when someone's asking me like, so how much do you charge for a logo? And then I start to ask back some really tough questions to this person and to help them unpack maybe some of this conditioned thinking that they have about value. And then it starts to mess up the internet. They're like, this is crazy. And so people start commenting, and you've seen the comments. I love reading their negative comments, by the way. I'm not saying do it, but I do love reading them. They'll say, this guy's an idiot. Oh, there's Fiverr. I'll do it for $5. No one will pay $18,000 for a logo. They go on and on and on and on about this thing. And the saddest part for me is many of them are creative people. It's not that there's a business coming in and saying, I would never pay a designer this much. It's designers and creative people saying, oh, I'll do it for less. And that's part of the problem, the culture that I'm trying to change. And so I think when you hit a nerve like that, things start to get real. And it almost always happened during these live tapings where, this is the beautiful part, you cannot plan for this. People will say something, they'll do something, and it will then spark an idea in you, and then you guys will go head to head, and somewhere in the middle is the truth. And that makes for really engaging content.
I got into a rabbit hole watching your stuff, Chris, I must say, in preparation for this interview. I mean, I've watched it before, but watching it again, especially knowing that we were going to have a chat, I just love it. I think it's so true. We have to pick a point and have a stance on something, or else if we're just trying to play it safe and trying to make everybody happy, then, well, why would they come and, you know, join us and follow us? So,
yeah,
I love that. Before you go, Chris, tell us about the future of the future. What's going on in the brand? What can we look forward to coming in 2022 and beyond?
Okay. The future of the future is that we've had some challenging 2 years here with the pandemic. We had the initial surge and spike with like audiences not knowing what to do with their time locked at home. And so we had this surge in viewership, and then people figure it out. Some of my plans got totally derailed, Pat, because prior to the pandemic, I was building out this, what I think is a 21st century classroom, which is this wide open space to learn and to share whiteboards, projectors, all this kind of stuff with cameras everywhere, like Big Brother style, like the TV show, right? And I thought I can invite great speakers and teachers to come and teach and not to worry about the technology. And then we can do our service to the community by broadcasting this out for low or no money at all. It helps the author, it helps the students, helps everybody. And I bought 100 chairs. I bought all kinds of stuff. And then boom, pandemic happens.
Yeah.
Downsize the office, get rid of all this stuff. So for me, I'm hoping that once this pandemic is under control and that we can have some semblance back to normal reality, I want to restart those plans, because I do really miss being around people. And like you said, those magical moments happen when we're together and we're like arguing, but in a way that is respectful and sometimes playful. I really miss that. I really define myself as an educator, and I want to continue experimenting with ways to teach people. And I'm looking forward to doing more of that.
I'm looking forward to seeing it from you, Chris. And, you know, if we're ever at a party together, both being introverts, you know, we'll be both on the wall together and we can spark up a conversation there. I promise you, because I'll be there as well.
We'll just stand quietly staring at each other, but not saying anything.
Middle school dances just are coming back to me. Chris, my friend, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much. Where should people go to follow and check you out?
I'm pretty easy to follow and find on the internet. I'm at the Chris Doe, and Doe is spelled D-O. That's it.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate you. Thanks for all you do, and we look forward to chatting again soon.
Thank you very much, Pat.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Chris Doe. Again, you can find him at The Future, T-H-E-F-U-T-U-R. That's future without the E. And I'm really excited about the future of the future, because Chris, as you can tell, is just an absolute wealth of knowledge. I invite you to subscribe to his YouTube channel and his podcast, The Future. And maybe you could check out the episode that I was on his podcast. It was a great interview. I just love talking to Chris. Just such a down-to-earth, amazing person who has a very, very good way of positioning, you know, these statements that help us as entrepreneurs and creatives. So definitely check him out. Chris, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom today. And you, thank you so much for listening in on this episode. I appreciate you. Make sure you hit that subscribe button so that you can get this and every other episode that's coming out and all the other episodes that are in our backlog your way as well. We have a lot of great stuff coming. And here we are. We're approaching, you know, midway, if not over halfway through Q1 of 2022. And we're just getting started. We got a lot of great stuff coming. Make sure you hit subscribe so you don't miss it. And thank you in advance for all the reviews and comments. I appreciate it so much. And I look forward to serving you in next week's episode. Oh, and you can check out the show notes for this episode at smartpassiveincome.com/session553. One more time, that's smartpassiveincome.com/session553. As always, take care. Peace out. Thank you. And Team Flynn for the win. Peace. Thanks for listening to the Smart Passive Income podcast at smartpassiveincome.com. I'm your host, Pat Flynn. Our senior producer is Sarah Jane Hess. Our series producer is David Grabowski. And our executive producer is Matt Gartland. Sound and video editing by Sean West Media. The Smart Passive Income podcast is a production of SPI Media. We'll catch you in the next session. Hey, if you're looking for a new podcast to add to your rotation, I've got one for you. It's called Dirty Money, and it's like a hybrid between a true crime and a business podcast. So hosts Jonathan Small and Dan Bova tell the tales of legendary scammers, con artists, and barely legal lowlifes who stop at nothing to rake in millions. Recent episodes include the man who looted $100 million from his own company. Crazy. Give it a listen. Head on over to Dirty Money right now on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or Stitcher.